This is Kurt Benrud with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our show. We're reading from Thomas Hardy's final novel, Jude the Obscure, first published in 1895. Like much of Hardy's work, this book is quite critical of that era's British society. The novel's divided into six parts, each part into several short chapters. Each part will be read by a pair of readers who alternate chapters. This broadcast is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Continuing our readings from Part Second at Christminster, Matthew Wood reads the odd chapters, Candace Davies reads the even chapters, and I'll be reading one near the end myself.
Chapter 3. But under the various deterrent influences, Jude's instinct was to approach her timidly, and the next Sunday he went to the morning service in the Cathedral Church of Cardinal College to gain a further view of her, for he had found that she had frequently attended there. She did not come, and he awaited her in the afternoon, which was finer. He knew that if she came at all, she would approach the building along the eastern side of the great green quadrangle, from which it was accessible, and he stood at the corner while the bell was going. A few minutes before the hour for service, she appeared as one of the figures walking along under the college walls, and at the sight of her he advanced up the side opposite and followed her into the building, more than ever glad that he had not as yet revealed himself. To see her, and to be himself unseen and unknown, was enough for him at present. He lingered a while in the vestibule, and the service was some way advanced when he was put into a seat. It was a luring, mournful, still afternoon, when a religion of some sort seemed a necessity to ordinary practical men, and not only a luxury of the emotional and leisured class. In the dim light and the baffling glare of the clerestory windows, he could discern the opposite worshippers indistinctly only, but he saw that Sue was among them. He had not long discovered the exact seat that she had occupied when the chanting of the 119th psalm, in which the choir was engaged, reached its second part, in quo corriget, the organ changing to a pathetic Gregorian tune as the singers gave forth, "Wherewithal shall a young man cleanse his way?" It was the very question that was engaging June's attention at this moment. What a wicked, worthless fellow he had been, to give vent, as he had done, to an animal passion for a woman, and allowed it to lead to such disastrous consequences. Then to think of putting an end to himself, then to go recklessly and to get drunk. The great waves of pedal music tumbled round the choir, and, nursed on the supernatural as he had been, it was not wonderful that he could hardly believe that the psalm was not specially sent by some regard providence for this moment of his first entry into the solemn building. And yet it was the ordinary psalm for the 24th evening of the month. The girl for whom he was beginning to nourish an extraordinary tenderness was at this time ensphered by the same harmonies as those which floated into his ears, and the thought was a delight to him. She was probably a frequenter of this place, and steeped body and soul in church sentiment, as she must be by occupant and habit, had, no doubt, much in common with him. To an impressionable and lonely young man, the consciousness of having at last found anchorage for his thought, which promised to supply social and spiritual possibilities, was like the dew of Hermon, as he remained throughout the service in a sustaining atmosphere of ecstasy. Though he was a loth to suspect it, some people might have said to him that the atmosphere blew as distinctly from Cyprus as from Galilee. Jude waited till she left her seat and passed under the screen before he himself moved. She did not look towards him, and by the time he reached the door she was halfway down the broad path. Being dressed up in his Sunday suit, he was inclined to follow her and reveal himself. But he was not quite ready, and alas, ought he not do so with the kind of feeling that was awakening in him? For though it had seemed to have had an ecclesiastical basis during the service, and he had persuaded himself that such was the case, he could not altogether be blind to the real nature of the magnetism. She was such a stranger that the kinship was affection, and he said, "It can't be. I, a man with a wife, must not know her." Still, Sue was his own kin, and the fact of his having a wife, even though she was not in evidence in the hemisphere, might be a help in one sense. It would put all thought of a tender wish on his part out of Sue's mind, and make her intercourse with him free and fearless. It was with some heartache that he saw how little he cared for the freedom and fearlessness that would result in her from such knowledge. Some little time before the date of his service in the cathedral, the pretty, liquid-eyed, light-footed young woman, Sue Bridehead, had an afternoon's holiday, and leaving the ecclesiastical establishment in which she not only assisted but lodged, took a walk into the country with a book in her hand. It was one of those cloudless days which sometimes occur in Wessex and elsewhere between days of cold and wet, as if intercalated by caprice of the weather god. She went along for a mile or two until she came to a much higher ground than that of the city she had left behind her. The road passed between green fields, and coming to a stile, Sue paused there to finish the page she was reading, and then looked back at the towers and domes and pinnacles, new and old. On the other side of the stile in the footpath, she beheld a foreigner with black hair and a sallow face, sitting on the grass beside a large square board whereupon were fixed as closely as they could stand a number of plaster statuettes, some of them bronzed, which he was rearranging before proceeding with them on his way. They were in the main reduced copies of ancient marbles and comprised divinities of a very different character from those the girl was accustomed to see portrayed, among them being a Venus of a standard pattern, a Diane, and of the other sex, Apollo, Bacchus, and Mars. Though the figures were many yards away from her, the southwest sun brought them out so brilliantly against the green herbage that she could discern their contours with luminous distinctions, and being almost in a line between herself and the church towers of the city, they awoke in her an oddly foreign and contrasting set of ideas by comparison. The man rose, and seeing her, politely took off his cap and cried, "Images!" in an accent that agreed with his appearance. In a moment, he dexterously lifted upon his knee the great board with its assembled notabilities, divine and human, and raised it to the top of his head, bringing them onto her and resting the board on the stiles. First he offered her his smaller wares, the busts of kings and queens, then a minstrel, then a winged cupid. She shook her head. "How much are these two?" she said, touching with her finger the Venus and the Apollo, the largest figures on the tray. He said she should have them for 10 shillings. "I cannot afford that," said Sue. She offered considerably less, and to her surprise the image man drew them from their wire stay and handed them over the stile. She classed them as treasures. When they were paid for and the man had gone, she began to be concerned as to what she should do with them. They seemed so very large now that they were in her possession, and so very naked. Being of a nervous temperament, she trembled at her enterprise. When she handled them, the white pipe clay came off on her gloves and jacket. After carrying them along a little way, openly, an idea came to her, and pulling some huge burdock leaves, parsley, and other rank growths from a hedge, she wrapped up her burden as well as she could in these, so that what she carried appeared to be an enormous armful of green stuff gathered by a zealot lover of nature. "Well, anything is better than those everlasting church follies," she said. But she was still in a trembling state, and seemed almost to wish she had not bought the figures. Occasionally peeping inside the leaves to see that Venus's arm was not broken, she entered with her heathen load into the most Christian city in the country, by an obscure street running parallel to the main one and round a corner to the side door of an establishment to which she was attached. Her purchases were taken straight up to her own chamber, and she at once attempted to lock them in a box that was her very own property. But finding them too cumbersome, she wrapped them in a large sheet of brown paper and stood them on the floor in the corner. The mistress of the house, Miss Fontover, was an elderly lady in spectacles, dressed almost like an abbess, a dab at ritual, as become one of her business and a worshipper of the ceremonial church of St. Silas in the suburb of Beersheba before mentioned, which Jude almost began to attend. She was the daughter of a clergyman in reduced circumstances at his death, which had occurred several years before this date. She boldly avoided penury by taking over a little shop of church requisites and developing it to its present creditable proportions. She wore a cross and beads round her neck as her only ornament and knew the Christian year by heart. She now came to call Sue to tea, and finding that the girl did not respond for a moment, entered the room just as the other was hastily putting a string round each parcel. "Something you've been buying, Miss Bridehead?" she asked regarding the enwrapped objects. "Yes, just something to ornament my room," said Sue. Well, I should have thought I had put enough here already, said Miss Fontover, looking around at the Gothic-framed prints of saints, the church text scrolls, and other articles which have become too stale to sell, have been used to furnish this obscure chamber. What is it? How bulky! She tore a little hole about as big as a wafer in the brown paper and tried to peep in. Why, statuary! Two figures! Where did you get them? Oh, I bought them of a traveling salesman who sells casts. Two saints? Yes. Which ones? Saint Peter and Saint Mary Magdalene. Well, now come down to tea and go and finish that organ text, if there's light enough afterwards. These little obstacles to the indulgences of what had been the merest passing fancy created in Sue a great zest for unpacking her objects and looking at them. And at bedtime, when she was sure of being undisturbed, she unrobed the divinities in comfort, placing the pair of figures on the chest drawer, a candle on each side of them. She withdrew to bed, flung herself down there, and began reading a book she had taken from her box, which Miss Fontover knew nothing of. It was a volume of Gibbon, and she read the chapter dealing with the reign of Julian the Apostate. Occasionally she looked up at the statuette, which appeared strange and out of place. There happened to be a Calvary print hanging between them, and as the scene suggested action, she at length jumped up and withdrew another book from her box, a volume of verse, and turned to the familiar poem, "Thou hast conquered, O pale Galilean! The world has grown gray from thy breath," which she read to the end. Presently she put out the candle, undressed, and finally extinguished her light. She was of an age which usually sleeps soundly, yet tonight she kept waking, and every time she opened her eyes there was enough diffused light from the candle to show her white plaster figures standing on the chest of drawers in odd contrast to their environment of text and martyr and the Gothic-framed crucifix picture that was only discernible now as a Latin cross, the figure thereon being obscured by the shades. On one of those occasions, the church clock struck some small hour. It fell upon the ear of another person who sat bending over his book at a not very distant spot in the same city. Being Saturday night, the morrow was one on which June had not set his alarm clock to catch him up at the usual early time, and hence he stayed up, as was his custom, 2 or 3 hours later than he could afford to do on any other day of the week. Just then he was earnestly reading from his greasebox text. At the very same time, Sue was tossing and staring at her figures. The policemen and belated citizens passing along under his window might have heard, if they had stood still, strange symbols mumbled with fervor within, words that had for Jude the indescribable enchantment, inexplicable sounds something like these: Al hemen hies teos ho pater, ex hauta panta kei hemis eis autan. Till the sounds rolled with reverent loudness as a book was heard to close. Cae his curios isos Christos dihau te panta cae hemis dia autau.
Chapter 4. He was a handyman at his trade, an all-round man, as artisans in country towns are apt to be. In London, the man who carves the boss, or knob, of leafage declines to cut the fragment of molding which merges in that leafage, as if it were a degradation to do the second half of one whole. When there was not much Gothic molding for Jude to run, or much window tracery at the banker's, he would go out lettering monuments or tombstones and take a pleasure in the change of handiwork. The next time that he saw her was when he was on a ladder executing a job of this sort inside one of the churches. There was a short morning service, and when the parson entered, Jude came down from his ladder and sat with a half-dozen people forming the congregation till the prayer should be ended and he could resume his tappings. He did not observe till the service was half over that one of the women was Sue, who had perforce accompanied the elderly Miss Fontover hither. Jude sat watching her pretty shoulders, her easy, curiously nonchalant risings and sittings, and her perfunctory genuflections, and thought what a help such an Anglican would have been to him in happier circumstances. It was not so much his anxiety to get on with his work that made him go up to it immediately the worshippers began to take their leave. It was that he dared not, in this holy spot, confront the woman who was beginning to influence him in such an indescribable manner. Those three enormous reasons why he must not attempt intimate acquaintance with Sue Brighthead, now that his interest in her had shown itself to be unmistakably of a sexual kind, loomed as stubbornly as ever. But it was also obvious that man could not live by work alone, that the particular man Jude, at any rate, wanted something to love. Some men would have rushed incontinently to her, snatched the pleasure of easy friendship, which she could hardly refuse, and have left the rest to chance. Not so Jude. at first. But as the days, and still more particularly the lonely evenings, dragged along, he found himself, to his moral consternation, to be thinking more of her instead of thinking less of her, and experiencing a fearful bliss in doing what was erratic, informal, and unexpected. Surrounded by her influence all day, walking past the spots she frequented, he was always thinking of her, and was obliged to own to himself that his conscience was likely to be the loser in this battle. To be sure, she was almost an idealty to him, still. Perhaps to know her would be to cure himself of this unexpected and unauthorized passion. A voice whispered that, though he desired to know her, he did not desire to be cured. There was not the least doubt that from his own orthodox point of view, the situation was growing immoral. For Sue, to be the loved one of a man who was licensed by the laws of his country to love Arabella, and none other, unto his life's end, was a pretty bad second beginning, where the man was bent on such a course as Jude proposed. This conviction was so real with him that one day, when, as was frequent, he was at work in a neighboring village church alone, he felt it to be his duty to pray against his weakness. But much as he wished to be an exemplar in these things, he could not get on. It was quite impossible, he found, to ask to be delivered from temptation when your heart's desire was to be tempted unto 70 times 7. So he excused himself. "After all," he said, "it is not altogether an erotolepsy that is the matter with me as at the first time. I can see that she is exceptionally bright, and it is partly a wish for intellectual sympathy, and a craving for loving-kindness in my solitude." Thus he went on adoring her, fearing to realize that it was human perversity. For whatever Sue's virtues, talents, or ecclesiastical saturation, it was certain that those items were not at all the cause of his affection for her. On an afternoon at this time, a young girl entered the stonemason's yard with some hesitation, and, lifting her skirts to avoid dragging them in the white dust, crossed towards the office. "That's a nice girl," said one of the men known as Uncle Joe. "Who is she?" asked another. "I don't know. I've seen her about here and there." "Why, yes, she's the daughter of that clever chap Bridehead who did all the wrought ironwork at St. Silas's 10 years ago and went away to London afterwards. I don't know what he's doing now, not much as I fancy, as she's come back here." Meanwhile, the young woman had knocked at the office door and asked if Mr. Jude Fawley was at work in the yard. It so happened that Jude had gone out somewhere or other that afternoon, which information she received with a look of disappointment, and went away immediately. When Jude returned, they told him and described her, whereupon he exclaimed, "Why, that's my cousin Sue!" He looked along the street after her, but she was out of sight. He had no longer any thought of a conscientious avoidance of her, and resolved to call upon her that very evening, and when he reached his lodging he found a note from her, a first note, one of those documents which, simple and commonplace in themselves, are seen retrospectively to have been pregnant with impassioned consequences. The very unconsciousness of a looming drama, which is shown in such innocent first epistles from woman to man, or vice versa, makes them, when such a drama follows, and they are read over by their purple or lurid light of it all, the more impressive, solemn, and in cases, terrible. Sue's was one of the most artless and natural kind. She addressed him as her dear cousin Jude, said she had only just learned by the merest accident that he was living in Christminster, and reproached him for not letting her know. They might have had such a nice time together, she said, for she was thrown much upon herself and had hardly any congenial friend. But now there was every possibility of her soon going away, so that the chance of companionship would be lost perhaps forever. A cold sweat overspread Jude at the news that she was going away. That was a contingency he had never thought of, and it spurred him to write all the more quickly to her. He would meet her that very evening, he said, 1 hour from the time of writing, at the cross in the pavement which marked the spot of martyrdoms. When he had dispatched the note by a boy, he regretted that in his hurry he had suggested to meet her out of doors, when he might have said he would call upon her. It was, in fact, the country custom to meet thus, and nothing else had occurred to him. Arabella had been met in the same way, unfortunately, and it might not seem respectable to a dear girl like Sue. However, it could not be helped now, and he moved towards the point a few minutes before the hour, under the glimmer of the newly lighted lamps. The broad street was silent and almost deserted, although it was not late. He saw a figure on the other side which turned out to be hers, and they both converged towards the cross mark at the same moment. Before either had reached it, she called out to him, "I am not going to meet you just there, for the first time in my life. Come further on." The voice, though positive and silvery, had been tremulous. They walked on in parallel lines, and, waiting her pleasure, Jude watched till she showed signs of closing in. Then he did likewise, the place being where the carrier's cart stood in the daytime, though here was none on the spot then. "I am sorry that I asked you to meet me and didn't call," began Jude with the bashfulness of a lover. "But I thought it would save time if we were going to walk." "Oh, I don't mind that," she said with the freedom of a friend. "I have really no place to ask anybody into. What I meant was that the place you chose was so horrid. I suppose I ought not to say horrid. I mean gloomy and inauspicious in its associations. But isn't it funny to begin like this when I don't know you yet?" She looked him up and down, curiously, though Jude did not look much at her. "You seem to know me more than I know you," she added.
Yes, I have seen you now and then."
"And you knew who I was, and didn't speak? And now I'm going away."
"Yes, that's unfortunate. I have hardly any other friends. I have indeed one very old friend here somewhere, but I don't quite like to call on him just yet. I wonder if you know anything of him, Mr. Phillotson? A parson somewhere about the country, I think he is."
"No, I only know of one Mr. Phillotson. He lives a little way out of the country, at Lumsden. He's a village schoolmaster."
"Ah, I wonder if he's the same. Surely it is possible. Only a schoolmaster still? Do you know his Christian name? Is it Richard?"
"Yes, it is. I've directed books to him, though I've never seen him."
"Then he couldn't do it." Jude's countenance fell. For how could he succeed in an enterprise wherein the great Phillotson had failed? He would have had a day of despair if the news had not arrived during his sweet Sue's presence. But even at this moment he had visions of how Phillotson's failure in the grand university scheme would depress him when she had gone. "As we are going to take a walk, suppose we go and call upon him," said Jude suddenly. "It's not late."
She agreed, and they went along up a hill and through some prettily wooded country. Presently the embattled tower and square turret of the church rose into the sky, and then the schoolhouse. They inquired of a person in the street if Mr. Phillotson was likely to be at home, and were informed that he was always at home. A knock brought him to the schoolhouse door, with a candle in his hand and a look of inquiry on his face, which had grown thin and careworn since Jude last set eyes on him. That after all these years the meeting with Mr. Phillotson should be of this homely complexion destroyed at one stroke the halo which had surrounded the schoolmaster's figure in Jude's imagination ever since their parting. It created in him at the same time a sympathy with Phillotson as an obviously much chastened and disappointed man. Jude told him his name and said he had come to see him as an old friend who had been kind to him in his youthful days. "I don't remember you in the least," said the schoolmaster thoughtfully. "You are one of my pupils, you say? Yes, no doubt. But they number so many thousands by this time of my life, and have naturally changed so much that I remember very few, except the quite recent ones."
"It was out at Marygreen," said Jude, wishing he had not come.
"Yes, I was there a short time. And is this an old pupil, too?"
"No, no, that's my cousin. I wrote to you for some grammars, if you recollect, and you sent them?"
"Ah, yes, I do dimly recall that incident."
"It was very kind of you to do it, and it was you who first started me on that course. On the morning you left Marygreen when your goods were on the wagon and you wished me goodbye and said your scheme was to be a university man and enter the church, that a degree was the necessary hallmark of one who wanted to do anything as a theologian or teacher."
"I remember I thought all that privately, but I wonder I did not keep my own counsel. That idea was given up years ago."
"Well, I have not forgotten it. It was that which brought me to this part of the country, and out here to see you tonight."
"Well, come in," said Phillotson, "and your cousin, too."
They entered the parlor of the schoolhouse, where there was a lamp with a paper shade, which threw the light down on three or four books. Phillotson took it off so that they could see each other better, and the rays fell on the nervous little face and vivacious dark eyes and hair of Sue, on the earnest features of her cousin, and on the schoolmaster's own mature face and figure, showing him to be a spare and thoughtful personage of 45, with a thin-lipped, somewhat refined mouth, a slightly stooping habit, and a black frock coat, which from continued friction shone a little at the shoulder blades, the middle of the back, and the elbows. The old friendship was imperceptibly renewed, the schoolmaster speaking of his experiences, and the cousins of theirs. He told them that he still thought of the church sometimes, and that though he could not enter it as he had intended to do in former years, he might enter it as a licentiate. Meanwhile, he said, he was comfortable in his present position, though he was in want of a pupil teacher. They did not stay to supper, Sue having to be indoors before it grew late, and the road was retraced to Christminster. Though they had talked of nothing more than general subjects, Jude was surprised to find what a revelation of woman his cousin was to him. She was so vibrant that everything she did seemed to have its source in feeling. An exciting thought would make her walk ahead so fast that he could hardly keep up with her, and her sensitivities on some points was such that it might have been misread as vanity. It was with heart sickness he perceived that, while her sentiments towards him were those of the frankest friendliness only, he loved her more than before becoming acquainted with her, and the gloom of the walk home lay not in the night overhead, but in the thought of her departure. "Why must you leave Christminster?" he said regretfully. "How can you do otherwise than cling to a city in whose history such men as Newman, Pusey, Ward, Keble loom so large?"
"Yes, they do. Though how large do they loom in the history of the world? What a funny reason for caring to stay. I should never have thought of it," she laughed. "Well, I must go. Miss Fontover, one of the partners whom I serve, is offended with me, and I with her, and it's best to go."
"How did that happen?"
"She broke some statuary of mine."
"Oh? Willfully?"
"Yes. She found it in my room, and though it was my property, she threw it on the floor and stamped on it, because it was not according to her taste, and ground the arms and the head of one of the figures all to bits with her heel. It's a horrid thing."
"Too Catholic apostolic for her, I suppose. No doubt she called them popish images and talked of the invocation of saints."
"Well, no. No, she didn't do that. She saw the matter quite differently."
"Ah, then I am surprised."
"Yes. It was for quite some other reason, and she didn't like my patron saints. So I was led to retort upon her, and the end of it was that I resolved not to stay, but to get into an occupation in which I shall be more independent."
"Why don't you try teaching again? You once did, I heard."
"I never thought of resuming it, for I was getting on as an art designer."
"Well, do let me ask Mr. Phillotson to let you try your hand in his school. If you like it, and go to a training college, and become a first-class certified mistress, you get twice as large as an income as any designer or church artist, and twice as much freedom."
"Well, ask him. Now I must go in. Goodbye, dear Jude. I am so glad we have met at last. We needn't quarrel because our parents did, need we?"
Jude did not like to let her see quite how much he agreed with her, and he went his way to the remote street in which he had his lodging. To keep Sue Bridehead near him was now a desire which operated without regard of consequences, and the next evening he again set out for Lumsden, fearing to trust to the persuasive effects of a note only. The schoolmaster was unprepared for such a proposal.
"What I rather wanted was a second year's transfer, as it is called," he said. "Of course your cousin would do, personally, but she's had no experience." "Oh, she has? Has she? Does she really think of adopting teaching as a profession?"
Jude said she was disposed to do so, he thought, and his ingenious arguments on her natural fitness for assisting Mr. Phillotson, of which Jude knew nothing whatsoever, so influenced the schoolmaster that he said he would engage her, assuring Jude, as a friend, that unless his cousin really meant to follow on in the same course, and regarded this step as the first stage of an apprenticeship, of which her training in a normal school would be the second stage, her time would be wasted quite, the salary being merely nominal. The day after this visit, Phillotson received a letter from Jude containing the information that he had again consulted his cousin, who took more and more warmly to the idea of tuition, and that she had agreed to come. It did not occur for a moment to the schoolmaster and recluse that Jude's ardor in promoting the arrangement arose from any other feeling towards Sue than the instinct of cooperation common among members of the same family.
Chapter 5. The schoolmaster sat in his homely dwelling attached to the school, both being modern erections, and he looked across the way at the old house in which his teacher Sue had a lodging. The arrangement had been concluded very quickly. A pupil teacher who was to have been transferred to Phillotson's school had failed him, and Sue had been taken as a stopgap. All such provisional arrangements as these could only last till the next annual visit of Her Majesty's Inspector, whose approval was necessary to make them permanent. Having taught for some 2 years in London, though she had abandoned that vocation of late, Miss Bridehead was not exactly a novice, and Phillotson thought there would be no difficulty in retaining her services, which he already wished to do, though she had only been with him 3 or 4 weeks. He had found her quite as bright as Jude had described her, and what master tradesman does not wish to keep an apprentice who saves him half his labor? It was a little over 8:30 in the morning, and he was waiting to see her cross the road to the school when he would follow. At 9:20 she did cross, a light hat tossed on her head, and he watched her as a curiosity. A new emanation which had nothing to do with her skill as a teacher seemed to surround him this morning. He went to the school also, and Sue remained governing her class at the other end of the room all day,
under his eye. She certainly was an excellent teacher. It was part of his duty to give her private lessons in the evening, and some article in the code made it necessary that a respectable elderly woman should be present at these lessons when the teacher and the taught were of different sexes. Richard Phillotson thought of the absurdity of the regulation in this case when he was old enough to be the girl's father, but he faithfully acted up to it and sat down with her in a room where Mrs. Hawes, the widow at whose house Sue lodged, occupied herself with sewing. The regulation was indeed not easy to evade, for there was no other sitting room in the dwelling. Sometimes, as she figured, it was arithmetic that they were working at, she would involuntarily glance up with a little inquiring smile at him, as if she assumed that, being the master, he must perceive all that was passing in her brain as right or wrong. Phillotson was not really thinking of the arithmetic at all, but of her, in a novel way which somehow seemed strange to him as preceptor. Perhaps she knew that he was thinking of her thus. For a few weeks their work had gone on with a monotony which in itself was a delight to him. Then it happened that the children were to be taken to Christminster to see an itinerant exhibition, in the shape of a model of Jerusalem, to which schools were admitted at a penny a head in the interests of education. They marched along the road two and two, she beside her class with her simple cotton sunshade, her little thumb cocked up against its stem, and Phillotson behind in his long dangling coat, handling his walking stick genteelly in the musing mood which had come over him since her arrival. The afternoon was one of sun and dust, and when they entered the exhibition room few people were present but themselves. The model of the ancient city stood in the middle of the apartment, and the proprietor, with a fine religious philanthropy written on his features, walked round it with a pointer in his hand, showing the young people the various quarters and places known to them by name from reading their Bibles. Mount Moriah, the Valley of Jehoshaphat, the City of Zion, the walls and the gates, outside one of which there was a large mound like a tumulus, and on the mound was a little white cross. The spot, he said, was Calvary. "I think," said Sue to the schoolmaster, as she stood with him a little in the background, "that this model, elaborate as it is a very imaginary production. How does anybody know that Jerusalem was like this in the time of Christ? I am sure this man doesn't. It is made after the best conjectural maps, based on actual visits to the city as it now exists. I fancy we have had enough of Jerusalem," she said, "considering we are not descended from the Jews. There was nothing first-rate about the place or people, after all, as there was about Athens, Rome, Alexandria, and the other old cities. But, my dear girl, consider what it is to us." She was silent, for she was easily repressed, and then perceived behind the group of children clustered around the model a young man in a white flannel jacket, his form being bent so low in his intent inspection of the Valley of Jehoshaphat that his face was almost hidden from view by the Mount of Olives. "Look at your cousin Jude," continued the schoolmaster. "He doesn't think we have had enough of Jerusalem." "Ah, I didn't see him," she cried in her quick, light voice. "Jude, how seriously you are going into it." Jude started up from his reverie and saw her. "Oh, Sue," he said with a glad flush of embarrassment. "These are your school children, of course. I saw that schools were admitted in the afternoons, and thought you might come up. But I got so deeply interested that I didn't remember where I was. How it carries one back, doesn't it? I could examine it for hours, but I have only a few minutes, unfortunately, for I am in the middle of a job here." "Your cousin is so terribly clever that she criticizes it unmercifully," said Phillotson, with good-humored satire. "She is quite skeptical as to its correctness." "No, Mr. Phillotson, I am not, altogether. I hate to be what is called a clever girl. There are too many of that sort now," answered Sue sensitively. "I only meant—I don't know what I meant, except that it was what you don't understand." "I know your meaning," said Jude ardently, although he did not, "and I think you are quite right. That's a good Jude. I know you believe in me." She impulsively seized his hand, and leaving a reproachful look on the schoolmaster, turned away to Jude, her voice revealing a tremor which she herself felt to be absurdly uncalled for by sarcasm so gentle. She had not the least conception how the hearts of the twain went out to her at this momentary revelation of feeling, and what a complication she was building up thereby in the futures of both. The model wore too much of an educational aspect for the children not to tire of it soon, and a little later in the afternoon they were all marched back to Lumsden, Jude returning to his work. He watched the juvenile flock in their clean frocks and pinafores filing down the street towards the country behind Phillotson and Sue, and a sad, dissatisfied sense of being out of the scheme of the latter's lives had possession of him. Phillotson had invited him to walk out and see them on Friday evening, when there would be no lessons to give to Sue, and Jude had eagerly promised to avail himself of the opportunity. Meanwhile, the scholars and teachers moved homewards, and the next day, on looking on the blackboard in Sue's class, Phillotson was surprised to find upon it, skillfully drawn in chalk, a perspective view of Jerusalem, with every building shown in its place. "I thought you took no interest in the model and hardly looked at it," he said. "I hardly did," said she, "but I remembered that much of it. It is more than I had remembered myself." Her Majesty's school inspector was at that time paying surprise visits in this neighborhood to test the teachers unawares, and 2 days later, in the middle of the morning lessons, the latch of the door was softly lifted, and in walked my gentleman, the King of Terrors, to pupil teachers. To Mr. Phillotson the surprise was not great. Like the lady in the story, he had been played that trick too many times to be unprepared. But Sue's class was at the farther end of the room, and her back was toward the entrance. The inspector therefore came and stood behind her and watched her teaching some half-minute before she became aware of his presence. She turned and realized that an oft-dreaded moment had come. The effect upon her timidity was such that she uttered a cry of fright. Phillotson, with a strange instinct of solicitude quite beyond his control, was at her side just in time to prevent her falling from faintness. She soon recovered herself and laughed. But when the inspector had gone, there was a reaction, and she was so white that Phillotson took her into his room and gave her some brandy to bring her round. She found him holding her hand. "You ought to have told me," she gasped petulantly, "that one of the inspector's surprise visits was imminent. Oh, what shall I do? Now he'll write and tell the managers that I am no good, and I shall be disgraced forever." "He won't do that, my dear little girl. You are the best teacher I ever had." He looked so gently at her that she was moved, and regretted that she had upbraided him. When she was better, she went home. Jude, in the meantime, had been waiting patiently for Friday. On both Wednesday and Thursday, he had been so much under the influence of his desire to see her that he had walked after dark some distance along the road in the direction of the village, and, on returning to his room to read, he found himself quite unable to concentrate his mind on the page. On Friday, as soon as he had got himself up, as he thought Sue would like to see him, and made a hasty tea, he set out, notwithstanding that the evening was wet. The trees overhead deepened the gloom of the hour, and they dripped sadly upon him, impressing him with forebodings. Illogical forebodings, for though he knew that he loved her, he also knew that he could not be more to her than he was. On turning the corner and entering the village, the first sight that greeted his eyes was that of two figures under one umbrella coming out of the vicarage gate. He was too far back for them to notice him, but he knew in a moment that they were Sue and Phillotson. The latter was holding the umbrella over her head, and they had evidently been paying a visit to the vicar, probably on some business connected with the schoolwork. And as they walked along the wet and deserted lane, Jude saw Phillotson place his arm around the girl's waist, whereupon she gently removed it. But he replaced it, and she let it remain, looking quickly round her with an air of misgiving. She did not look absolutely behind her, and therefore did not see Jude, who sank into the hedge like one struck with a blight. There he remained hidden till they had reached Sue's cottage, and she had passed in, Phillotson going on to the school hard by. "He's too old for her, too old!" cried Jude in all the terrible sickness of hopeless, handicapped love. He could not interfere. Was he not Arabella's? He was unable to go on further and retraced his steps toward Christminster. Every tread of his feet seemed to say to him that he must on no account stand in the schoolmaster's way with Sue. Phillotson was perhaps 20 years her senior, but many a happy marriage had been made in such conditions of age. The ironical clinch to his sorrow was given by the thought that the intimacy between his cousin and the schoolmaster had been brought about entirely by himself.
Chapter 6. Jude's old and embittered aunt lay unwell at Mary Green, and on the following Sunday he went to see her, a visit which was the result of a victorious struggle against his inclination to turn aside to the village of Lumsden and obtain a miserable interview with his cousin, in which the word nearest his heart could not be spoken, and the sight which had tortured him could not be revealed. His aunt was now unable to leave her bed, and a great part of Jude's short day was occupied in making arrangements for her comfort. The little bakery business had been sold to a neighbor, and with the proceeds of this and her savings, she was comfortably supplied with necessaries and more, a widow of the same village living with her and ministering to her wants. It was not till the time had nearly come for him to leave that he obtained a quiet talk with her, and his words tended insensibly towards his cousin. "Was Sue born here?"
"She was, in this room. They were living here at that time. What made he ask that?"
"Oh, I wanted to know."
"Now you've been seeing her," said the harsh old woman. "And what did I tell you?"
"Well, that I was not to see her."
"Have you gossiped with her?"
"Yes."
"Then don't keep it up. She was brought up by her father to hate her mother's family, and she'll look with no favor upon a working chap like you, a townish girl as she's become now. I never cared much about her. A pert little thing, that's what she was too often, with her tight-strained nerves. Many's the time I've smacked her for her impertinence. Why, one day, when she was walking into the pond with her shoes and stockings off and her petticoats pulled up over her knees, afore I could cry out for shame, she said, 'Move on, Auntie, this is no sight for modest eyes.'"
"She was a little child then."
"She was 12 of a day."
"Well, of course. But now she's older. She's of a thoughtful, quivering, tender nature, and as sensitive as—"
"Jude!" cried his aunt, springing up in bed. "Don't you be a fool about her."
No, of course not.
"Your marrying that woman Arabella was about as bad a thing as a man could possibly do for himself by trying hard. But she's gone the other side of the world and may never trouble you again. And there'll be a worse thing if you, tied and bound as you be, should have a fancy for Sue. If your cousin is civil to you, take her civility for what it is worth. Anything more than a relation's good wishes is stark madness for ye to give her. If she's townish and wanton, it med bring ye to ruin."
"Don't say anything against her, aunt. Don't, please." A relief was afforded to him by the entry of the companion and nurse of his aunt, who must have been listening to the conversation, for she began a commentary on past years, introducing Sue Brighthead as a character in her recollections. She described what an odd little maid Sue had been when a pupil at the village school across the green opposite, before her father went to London, how, when the vicar arranged readings and recitations, she appeared on the platform, the smallest of them all,
"in her little white frock and shoes and pink sash."
How she recited Excelsior,
"There was a sound of revelry by night,"
and The Raven. How during the delivery she would knit her little brows and glare around tragically, and say to the empty air, as if some real creature stood there,
"Ghastly, grim, and ancient raven, wandering from the nightly shore, tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore." "She'd bring up the nasty carrion bird, that's clear," corroborated the sick woman reluctantly, "as she stood there in her little sash and things, that you could see in a'most before your very eyes. You too, Jude, had the same trick of a child of seeing things in the air."
The neighbor told also of Sue's accomplishments and other kinds.
"She was not exactly a tomboy, you know, but she could do things that only boys do as a rule. I've seen her hit in and steer down the long slide on yonder pond, with her little curls blowing, one of a file of 20 moving along against the sky like shapes painted on glass, and up the backside without stopping. All boys except herself, and then they'd cheer her, and then she'd say, 'Don't be saucy, boys,' and suddenly run indoors. They'd try to coax her out again, but A's wouldn't come."
These retrospective visions of Sue made Jude the more miserable than he was unable to woo her, and he left the cottage of his aunt that very day with a heavy heart. He would fain have glanced into the school to see the room in which Sue's little figure had so glorified itself, but he checked his desire and went on. It being Sunday evening, some villagers who had known him during his residence here were standing in a group in their best clothes. Jude was startled by a salute from one of them.
"You've got there right enough, then."
Jude showed that he did not understand.
Why, to the seat of Larnin, the City of Lights. You used to talk to us about it as a little boy. Is it all you expected of it?
Yes, more, cried Jude.
When I was there once for an hour, I didn't see much of it for my part. Old crumbling buildings, half church, half almshouse. Not much going on that.
Well, you are wrong, John. There is more going on than meets the eye of a man walking through the streets. It is a unique center of thought and religion, the intellectual and spiritual granary of this country. All that silence and absence of goings-on. It's the stillness of infinite motion. The sleep of the spinning top, to borrow the simile of a well-known writer.
Ah, well, it med be all that, or it med not. As I say, I didn't see nothing of it all the hour or two I was there. So I went in and had a pot of beer, and a penny loaf, and a half-porth of cheese, and waited till it was time to come along home. You've joined a college by the time, I suppose?
No, said Jude. I am almost as far off that as ever.
How so?
Jude slapped his pockets.
Just what we thought. Such places be not for such as you, only for them with plenty of money.
Well, there you are wrong, said Jude with some bitterness. They are for such ones. Still, the remark was sufficient to withdraw Jude's attention from the imaginative world he had lately inhabited, in which an abstract figure, more or less himself, was steeping his mind in a sublimation of the arts and sciences, and making his calling and election sure to a seat in the paradise of the learned. He was set regarding his prospects in a cold northern light. He had lately felt that he could not quite satisfy himself in his Greek, in the Greek of the dramatist particularly. So fatigued was he sometimes after his day's work that he could not maintain the critical attention necessary for thorough application. He felt that he wanted a coach, a friend at his elbow, to tell him in a moment what sometimes would occupy him a weary month in extracting from unanticipative, clumsy books. It was decidedly necessary to consider the facts a little more closely than he had done of late. What was good, after all, of using up his spare hours in a vague labor called private study, without giving an outlook on the practicabilities? "I ought to have thought of this before," he said as he journeyed back. "It would have been better never to have embarked in this scheme at all than do it without seeing clearly where I am going or what I am aiming at. This hovering outside the walls of the colleges, as if expecting some arm to be stretched out from them to lift me inside, won't do. I must get special information." The next week, accordingly, he sought it. When it first seemed an opportunity occurred one afternoon when he saw an elderly gentleman, who had been pointed out as the head of a particular college, walking in the public path of a park-like enclosure near the spot at which Jude chanced to be sitting. The gentleman came nearer, and Jude looked anxiously at his face. It seemed benign, considerate, yet rather reserved. On second thoughts, Jude felt that he could not go up and address him, but he was sufficiently influenced by the incident to think what a wise thing it would be for him to state his difficulties by letter to some of the best and most judicious of these old masters and obtain their advice. During the next week or two, he accordingly placed himself in such positions about the city as would afford him glimpses of several of the most distinguished among the provosts, wardens, and other heads of houses, and from those he ultimately selected five, whose physiognomies seemed to say to him that they were appreciative and far-seeing men. To these five he addressed letters, briefly stating his difficulties and asking their opinion on his stranded situation. When the letters were posted, Jude mentally began to criticize them. He wished they had not been sent. It was just one of those intrusive, vulgar, pushing applications which are so common in these days, he thought. Why couldn't I know better than address utter strangers in such a way? I may be an impostor, an idle scamp, a man with a bad character, for all they know, to the contrary. Perhaps that's what I am. Nevertheless, he found himself clinging to the hope of some reply as to his one last chance of redemption. He waited day after day, saying that it was perfectly absurd to expect, yet expecting. While he waited, he was suddenly stirred by news about Phillotson. Phillotson was giving up the school near Christminster for a larger one further south in mid-Wessex. What this meant, how it would affect his cousin, whether, as seemed possible, it was a practical move of the schoolmaster's toward a larger income, in view of a provision for two instead of one, he would not allow himself to say. And the tender relations between Phillotson and the young girl of whom Jude was passionately enamored effectually made it repugnant to Jude's taste to apply to Phillotson for advice on his own scheme. Meanwhile, the academic dignitaries to whom Jude had written vouchsafed no answer, and the young man was thrown back entirely on himself, as formerly, with the added gloom of a weakened hope.
By indirect inquiries, he soon perceived clearly what he had long uneasily suspected, that to qualify himself for certain open scholarships and exhibitions was the only brilliant course. But to do this, a good deal of coaching would be necessary, and much natural ability. It was next to impossible that a man, reading on his own system, however widely and thoroughly, even over the prolonged period of 10 years, should be able to compete with those who had passed their lives under trained teachers and worked to ordained lines. The other course, that of buying himself in, so to speak, seemed the only one really open to men like him, the difficulty being simply of a material kind. With the help of his information, he began to reckon the extent of this material obstacle, and ascertained, to his dismay, that at the rate at which, with the best of fortune, he would be able to save money, 15 years would elapse before he could be in a position to forward testimonials to the head of the college and advance to a matriculation examination. The undertaking was hopeless. He saw what a curious and cunning glamour the neighborhood of the place had exercised over him. To get there and live there, to move among the churches and halls and become imbued with a genius loci, had seemed to his dreaming youth, as this spot shaped its charms to him from its halo on the horizon, the obvious and ideal thing to do. "Let me only get there," he had said with the fatuousness of Crusoe over his big boat, "and the rest is but a matter of time and energy." It would have been far better for him in every way if he had never come within sight and sound of the delusive precincts, had gone to some busy commercial town with the sole object of making money by his wits, and thence surveyed his palm in true perspective. Well, all that was clear to him amounted to this, that the whole scheme had burst up like an iridescent soap bubble under the touch of a reasoned inquiry. He looked back at himself along the vista of his past years, and his thought was akin to Heine's. "Above the youth's inspired and flashing eyes, I see the motley, mocking fool's cap rise." Fortunately, he had not been allowed to bring his disappointment into his dear Sue's life by involving her in his collapse, and the painful details of his awakening to a sense of his limitations should now be spared her as far as possible. After all, she had only known a little part of the miserable struggle in which he had been engaged, thus unequipped, poor, and unforeseeing. He always remembered the appearance of the afternoon on which he awoke from his dream, not quite knowing what to do with himself. He went up to an octagonal chamber in the lantern of the singularly built theater that was set amidst this quaint and singular city. It had windows all round, from which an outlook over the whole town and its edifices could be gained. Jude's eyes swept all the views in succession, meditatively, mournfully, yet sturdily. These buildings and their associations and privileges were not for him. From the looming roof of the great library, into which he hardly ever had time to enter, his gaze traveled on to the varied spires, halls, gables, streets, chapels, gardens, quadrangles, which composed the ensemble of this unrivaled panorama. He saw that his destiny lay not with these, but among the manual toilers in the shabby purlieu which he himself occupied, unrecognized as part of the city at all by its visitors and panegyrists, yet without whose denizens the hard readers could not read, nor the high thinkers think. He looked over the town into the country beyond to the trees which screened her whose presence had at first been the support of his heart, and whose loss was now a maddening torture. But for this blow, he might have borne with his fate. With Sue as companion, he could have renounced his ambitions with a smile. Without her, it was inevitable that the reaction from the long strain to which he had subjected himself should affect him disastrously. Phillotson had no doubt passed through a similar intellectual disappointment to that which now enveloped him. But the schoolmaster had been since blessed with the consolation of sweet Sue, while for him there was no consoler. Descending to the streets, he went listlessly along till he arrived at an inn and entered it. Here he drank several glasses of beer in rapid succession, and when he came out it was night. By the light of the flickering lamps he rambled home to supper, and had not long been sitting at a table when his landlady brought up a letter that had just arrived for him. She laid it down as if impressed with a sense of its possible importance, and, on looking at it, Jude perceived that it bore the embossed stamp of one of the colleges whose heads he had addressed. "One, at last!" cried Jude. The communication was brief, and not exactly what he had anticipated, though it really was from the master in person, and it ran thus: "Biblio College,
Sir, I have read your letter with interest, and judging from your description of yourself as a working man, I venture to think that you will have a much better chance of success in life by remaining in your own sphere and sticking to your trade than by adopting any other course. That, therefore, is what I advise you to do. Yours faithfully, T. Tutifeni, to Mr. J. Fowley Stonemason.
This terribly sensible advice exasperated Jude. He had known all that before. He knew it was true. Yet it seemed a hard slap after 10 years of labor, and its effect upon him just now was to make him rise recklessly from the table, and instead of reading, as usual, to go downstairs and into the street. He stood at a bar and tossed off 2 or 3 glasses, then unconsciously sauntered along till he came to a spot called the Four Ways, in the middle of the city, gazing abstractedly at the groups of people like one in a trance, till, coming to himself, he began talking to the policeman fixed there. That officer yawned, stretched out his elbows, elevating himself an inch or two on the balls of his toes, smiled and looked humorously at Jude, and said,
"You've had a wet, young lad."
"No, I've only begun," he replied cynically. Whatever his wetness, his brains were dry enough. He only heard in part the policeman's further remarks, having fallen into thought on what struggling people like himself had stood at the crossway, whom nobody ever thought of now. It had more history than the oldest college in the city. It was literally teeming, stratified with the shades of human groups, who had met there for tragedy, comedy, farce, real enactments of the intensest kind. At Four Ways, men had stood and talked of Napoleon, the loss of America, the execution of King Charles, the burning of the martyrs, the Crusades, the Norman conquest, possibly the arrival of Caesar. Here the two sexes had met for loving, hating, coupling, parting. They'd waited, suffered for each other, had triumphed over each other, cursed each other in jealousy, blessed each other in forgiveness. He began to see that the town life was a book of humanity, infinitely more palpitating, varied, and compendious than the gown life. These struggling men and women before him were the reality of Christminster. Though they knew little of Christ or Minster, that was one of the humorous things. The floating population of students and teachers, who did know both in a way, were not Christminster in a local sense at all. He looked at his watch, and in pursuit of this idea, he went on till he came to a public hall, where a promenade concert was in progress. Jude entered and found the room full of shop youths and girls, soldiers, apprentices, boys of 11 smoking cigarettes, and light women of the more respectable and amateur class. He had tapped the real Christminster life. A band was playing, and the crowd walked about and jostled each other, and every now and then a man got upon a platform and sang a comic song. The spirit of Sue seemed to hover round him and prevent his flirting and drinking with the frolicsome girls who made advances, wistful to gain a little joy. At 10 o'clock he came away, choosing a circuitous route homeward, to pass the gates of the college, whose head had just sent him the note. The gates were shut, and by an impulse he took from his pocket the lump of chalk, which, as a workman, he usually carried there, and he wrote along the walls. "I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Yea, who knoweth not such things as these?" Job 12.
Well, that's it for this program of readings from Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Check back with us at the same time next week. We'll read another episode. Meanwhile, thanks from me. Thanks from today's readers. Glad to have you tuning in. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Have a good day.